I'm Matthew Soper from Hampshire Carnivorous Plants.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
It's another Friday afternoon and you're listening to another episode of the Sideshow. You'll hear people around me, you'll hear generators going in the background, you might hear a lady dancing who's doing security behind me as well. We're in a good, happy place. I'm standing in the middle, just about got that one out, of the floral marquee. Matthew, I believe this is the first time ever on the Sideshow for us to discuss carnivorous plants. Whilst I studied horticulture and know some of these answers, all of them, in fact, I am the El Guapo and I am the most intelligent. Wait for it.
If you're just leaving us this evening, please don't forget to pick up your plants from the plant crash.
Right, that's that announcement done. Explain to those who are not aware, what are carnivorous plants?
Carnivorous plants are plants which have adapted in one way or another to gain their nourishment from insects or in some cases small mammals rather than from the soil. So these are plants that grow in impoverished soils and gain their food from mainly flying insects.
You could have, bearing in mind the Sideshow has had, let's say, Hardy's Nurseries on, Rosie Anthrop, two absolute legends of the horticultural scene. You could have chose to grow what I will now describe as normal plants. At what age did you develop an interest in carnivorous plants to start with?
Right, I was 7 years old and I was watching a natural history programme. I think it was a David Attenborough thing, and there was a Venus flytrap. It filled the screen, and I remember it closing on a fly, and that was it. It grabbed me. I really wanted one. A neighbour managed to find one in a local garden centre. It was tiny. I remember I got the thing home, got a pair of tweezers and a piece of chocolate, and I poked it and made the trap shut. Died in about 3 or 4 weeks. Didn't last very long at all. I was still keen, and I was bought the second plant. And with the second plant in hand and a small book entitled Carnivorous Plants, I was quite successful and got it to produce quite a large plant the size of a washing-up bowl. So it was that initial television programme that got me interested in carnivorous plants.
All right. Most people who listen to the show, sorry, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow and sideshow.com if you need to get in touch or you need to know a little bit more about Matthew. And don't worry, if you're stuck for that, again, just press that middle button on your iPhone, send us a note on Twitter or Instagram or something, and we'll put you directly in touch. I'll give you all his details. You don't need to write it down, right? Sideshow bingo. I used to grow plants under my bed when I was 5. Mine were kind of, let's say, cactus and radish seeds and whatever else I could lay my hands on with 10p, 20p pocket money. Did your parents and your parents' mates turn around and say, and this isn't, I'm not knocking you, but did they go, where's Matthew? Oh, he's playing with the plants again. She, what colour is he growing? Roses? No. Hydrangeas? No. Pears, maybe some from the ericaceous range? No. Did you have that, the empathise with that question?
Yes, I did, yeah. The Venus flytrap. Oh, not those plants again. Nothing. Everyone was interested in flowery plants, fuchsias, like you say, hydrangeas and things, but carnivorous plants is what captured me. And I just found them fascinating, more than any other plant. I wasn't interested in gardening at all. It was just the Venus flytrap was the initial plant because it moved. It moved, that was the thing.
You're now a grown man, relatively speaking, around the same height as me. You shave and you've got a jacket on and you look smarter than me, right? So you've got a car and I gather you have a mortgage, just to put in context. But you, yeah, because I know I stammered there, but I've got me in my head, and there are very few people who I know at 5, 6, 7 years of age are still doing what it was that they saw. Some have an interest in it, and are accountants, or have a normal job, like I should have, or no offence, but you should have as well, and do it as a hobby. But this is your living. What was the bit in between you being 7 years of age, my apologies, and you going to the bank and them saying, what do you do for a living, Mr. Matthew, and you saying, I grow carnivorous plants. Oh, not this story again, seriously, do I have to, do you get that, what was the chunk in the middle?
No, there was a big bit in the middle. I grew the carnivorous plants as a hobby, and I kept growing them as a hobby, but by trade I was a builder, I was a bricklayer, So I worked as a bricklayer and grew these plants as a hobby. And there came a point, I went to work in Germany in the 90s, saved some money up. And when I came back, I thought, right, I'm going to expand my hobby and try and turn it into a business. And I entered Southampton Balloon and Flower Festival. This was back in 1995. And that was the first flower show we entered, and we got a gold medal the first time we went there. And that's how the business started to grow from that. So I was a builder by trade. It wasn't Venus flytraps all the way through.
All right, okay, I buy that. So I'm going to ask you a mildly personal question. Do you have family?
I do, yeah. I'm married with two children, Rebecca and Daisy, yeah.
So you turn around to the good lady and you're out the back garden building the barbecue and you've got a bit of match of the day on and you're home on essentially a Sunday, a Saturday kind of thing. And you say, darling, I have a, to quote Blackadder, I have a cunning plan. I'm going to drop in the semi-normal job, no disrespect, which is the bricklaying part of it. And I'm going to do this full-time for a living because I won a medal at a garden show. She said, that's the sanest decision you ever came up with.
Well, the good thing was that I'd always been self-employed as a builder. And in that respect, if there's no work about, you don't work. So it was really good. It fitted in when there wasn't flower shows and I was still building. So there was a transitional period when I was bricking and selling plants. It worked really well. And then it came to a point where I was doing less and less building work and more carnivorous plant business like mail order and doing more shows. And I got into the RHS shows such as Chelsea, Hampton Court, BBC Gardeners World. And, you know, it just slowly grew, just slowly grew.
I know everybody who I talk to, the cliche, I say the cliche, I mean, it's a bit like, why does Peter do the sod show? Have I got a sponsor? No. Why do I take money out of my own, you know, back pocket to stay in they'd no jacuzzi in my hotel room, as a by the way, but the travel lodge in Knutsford. Didn't have Ferrero Rocher under my pillow either. The question is always why, and the answer in from my perspective is, well, look, I don't play golf. If I had a Ferrari, I'd find it a pointless vehicle. I'd want to put a tow hitch on at minimum and maybe take the roof off it so I could get some, you know, clematis or something. I don't know. It makes sense in my head, or at least I'm happy. Again, your folks looking at the window at you, kind of going, 7-year-old Matthew, or Peter in this case, playing at the back garden, growing something. Do you absolutely love what you do? Are there bits of it that get in your nerves, or are there bits that you wish that you could change? Because I met you yesterday and you strike me as one of those happy, to use the Father Ted line, you strike me as quite a happy fecker, so long as you're surrounded by, as I would call them, my little babies.
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoy growing the plants, but it has changed. Initially, as I said to you, it was a moving Venus flytrap. Now, I tell you, I find the Venus flytrap the least interesting of all the carnivorous plants now. I really have no interest in those. And the ones I'm keen on now are the North American pitcher plants, the Sarracenia. I do a lot of plant breeding, playing God, as it were. That's what I enjoy doing now, is breeding new forms and varieties. And I've been doing that for quite a few years now. And we've named quite a few cultivars. And that's what I enjoy now, is breeding the plants.
And I appreciate that from two people in my head. One is Peter has to go out and make gardens for real. And in exchange for that, people will cross my palm with silver. And the other is Peter, who is quite happy trying to play with phototropism, plants leaning towards the light, for those without that knowledge of that word. But goofing around with that and trying to get them to bend and shape them to almost spell out people's names, whilst I know they're going to straighten up. So it's like reversing a truck with two trailers on the back of it. It can never entirely work out, but it's still a quandary challenge thing in my head of, can I? I'll prove you wrong, so to speak. Plant breeding doesn't always pay the bills. It's beautifully successful in my head when you get a plant to do X, and little Peter in little Peter's head gets to go, yeah, we, the both of us, the little person and the real person, we achieved that. But it doesn't always pay the bills. Does the point to make sense to you?
Well, it does now, because I've got to a point where we've got really good stock, and my own breeding program, the plants are quite desirable, some of the rarer forms and some of my own cultivars. And initially that they weren't paying the bills, but now we've got quite a good reputation and people will pay good money for very unusual forms. And that's what we're concentrating on, trying to produce my own stock, my own plants. No one else are selling. So that's the way forward my business is going now. Whereas before it was just like run-of-the-mill carnivorous plants. Now it's making our own cultivars.
I mean, you're either going to get into garden design or you'll get into plant breeding or you'll come to a show like Tatton or Chelsea or Hampton and you'll see the guys who've designed gardens first time, and you kind of have to query why somebody would maybe sponsor themselves to go do that maybe on one level, or why you would leave a semi-normal, real job to go breeding, not just breeding plants, but breeding carnivorous plants. Did you have the moments, I know I had when I set up Donegan Landscaping, I had the moments where you almost bang your head off a wall and go, why did I make this? I'm a moron. I really shouldn't have done this.
Very much so. I think one of them was at Hampton Court, being opposite Rob Hardy. I was there with my little carnivorous plant display. He had this herbaceous display opposite, and there people running in and out with plants to fill the selling table. And my display was there with very few customers. And I thought, what am I doing? If something's obscure and not that popular. You know, I may well like them, but I need to make a living, as you're saying. This is just like banging my head against the wall. But I stuck with it. And now we've had 19 consecutive Chelsea gold medals. We've got a reputation as one of the best breeders in the world of carnivorous plants. We've got the largest collection of large specimen Sarracenias in Europe by far. And I stuck with it. And it proves if you do stick with it. And I've done something that isn't that popular, but I've just stuck with it. And it's pays bills. And I'm making a living from it. Something I enjoy, which, as you know, is hard to do.
Yeah, and it is hard to do. And I guess, look, I apologise to those who listen at home. There is two sides to this. People can turn around and people do, and you hear it, Matthew, all the time. People say, oh, I love what I do. And I go, yeah, but you're broke. Your car's a heap of wreck. You know, you can't afford to buy a pint because you're living the dream, working in the great outdoors. And there is a balance between fueling the passion, funding the passion, and also having to do the real deal. And it's a funny balance when you're trying to get it to click. And in designer terms, in garden making terms, whether it's plant breeding as you're doing it, but if you're a little bit the exception, when you're in vogue, you're in vogue. But if the trends flip, you've got another challenge, as discussed when I was talking to Cookie about the hydrangeas.
No, you're right. I mean, it hasn't all been beer and skittles, as they say. It's been really hard, a lot of work, and there's been lots of hard times. Now I'm 52, so I've been doing the flower shows for 24 years, and it's hard work to build up the reputation to get where I am now. I mean, well, you know yourself with garden, it's hard.
Well, Donegan Landscaping is 16 years old, and I think people tend to ask me why a lot. The role has flipped where I was 7, 6, and I was asking my dad why the plants lean towards the light. An answer he didn't. And, well, he said it was, you know, leaning towards the light, but I was that annoying child that wanted to know why. And he couldn't give it to me. And now I'm 41 and people are saying to me, well, why do you do the sod show? And for all its popularity, if I might, you know, say it that, it's the opposite of paying the bills. It's had some good days in the sunshine, but it doesn't do it. Let's flip it ever so slightly to the left. For those listening to this at home who are saying, right, carnivorous plants, they've got the iPhone in their hand, they're on the tube, they're on the train, so they can press that middle button and go see images of this stuff. Give me your top 5 plants, and then we'll get into the why.
Number 1, Sarracenia. Jutta tipsopa, bright pink pitcher plant.
Explain how that one works.
Right, it's a pitfall trap. I've got one here, and I'll explain what they look like. They form these long tubes. This one, Jutta tipsopa, is my own hybrid, named for my wife. My wife's originally from Thailand, that's why it's quite an unusual name. And it produces bright pink tubes. Now, when I bred this one, I made the cross in 1998, and all the seedlings were like a greeny colour, but this one shone like a beacon. You can see it's almost a luminous pink. So I selected it out, and we got it in tissue culture, and we've come quite a long way with it. The reason why I like these is because they're easy to grow. You can grow them in an unheated greenhouse or outside in the cold, and they're by far the most efficient fly catchers, and it's this bright pink colour, so it's very, very pretty, and beautiful pink flowers in the spring as well.
Explain to me how essentially a plant that stands still catches the insect.
Right. They produce this nectar around the mouth. You can see it's like a trumpet-shaped appendage. Can you see this nectar here? The nectar is very sweet, but it also has an intoxicating effect on insects. So when they fly in and eat the nectar, makes them a bit drunk. They fall down into the tube. There are downward pointing hairs further down in the tube, so the more they struggle, the further down they go. And where the downward pointing hairs makes it difficult for them to climb back out again. Further down, there's a pool of digestive fluid. Once they get into there, they slowly get broken down. That's where the plant gets its nitrogen from.
It's a little bit nasty, isn't it? Wow, it's like if you go down to the woods today kind of a story. But there's still plants, but they still photosynthesize.
They do take a small amount of nitrogen up through the root system, but not that much. But most of their food comes from insects. And these, the North American pitcher plants or Sarracenia, really do work. They catch loads of wasps and flies, especially in the late summer.
There's a baby wailing, as you might call it, back home in the background. I'm unsure why. It's either that, I'm not too sure what it is, but it sounds like a baby. Number two was the Venus flytrap. You better remember the order of all of these. Yeah. Let's get into that one. Because I know the most of these, but you obviously know them a lot better in depth than I would.
Yeah, the Venus flytrap, commonly known as Dyneema scipula. This is the one that captured my imagination and the one that moves. You can see that's why I would put it at number two, behind the Sarracenia, because it was the first one that I bought, but I still prefer the pitcher plants. They move, they're unusual. They come from a small area around Wilmington in North Carolina, which is only about 40 square miles. That's the only place you'll find them in the wild. But they're extremely popular with children. And today, I still think they are the best plant to get children into horticultural gardening. It got me, and what other plant can do that apart from mimosa, maybe?
I was just about to say the mimosa. For those who aren't aware, if you touch a mimosa, all of the petals kind of pull back one direction. It's suggested, obviously nobody asked the plant, but it's a self-defense mechanism of essentially all of the leaves fall down in a nutshell in audio, and you'd kind of wonder why, because you could just break the thing in half if you felt like it anyway. But how does the mechanism in the Venus flytrap actually work?
Inside the mouth of the trap, there are three trigger hairs on each lobe. If one of these trigger hairs is touched twice, the trap quickly closes. If it's just touched once, it remains open, because it could be a raindrop or a twig falling in there.
Very smart.
The trigger hairs are spaced apart, quite far apart, because if something the size of an ant went in there, it's too small to touch two trigger hairs. The plant would use more energy closing than it would gain from eating an ant. So it wants to catch something the size of a housefly. These are clever plants. If you touch the trigger hair once and wait for another 5 seconds and touch it again, it will remain open. They can actually count and sense time. Twice like this, one, two, bang.
Wow.
One, stays open, nothing. Yeah. Charles Darwin said it was the most amazing plant in the world. They are.
There are things in my head that fascinated me, but I still knew that I couldn't afford a Venus flytrap as a nipper. I could buy a sieve, and I could grow the seeds that I bought the previous week with that when I was seven. So that's how we differed slightly. So the next one that we have on the go is
Drosera capensis, sundew, the South African sundew. This one is the easiest of all carnivorous plants, and I would say this is the best beginner's plant for a number of reasons. One, it's easy to grow. You just stand it in a source of rainwater. It grows easily. It's very free flowering. The flowers are self-pollinating, so if you leave the flowerscape on there to turn brown, you can shake the seed out and grow the plants on from seed. Extremely easy. If kids get a magnifying glass, I don't know if you can see, they produce these long leaves which are covered in very sticky tentacles. This is not dew, as the name suggests. It's actually a glue that the plant produces. If I just touch it, it might be to see just how sticky they are. Now, something the size of a housefly lands on this plant, the leaf also has the power of movement. It can actually curl around the fly and ensnare it. And they're fantastic for young kids to look at through magnifying glasses, as I say. Easy to grow, fascinating plant. And we have three natives in the British Isles as well.
Okay, that's number three. Let's go to number four. And if you're wondering, I'll get photographs of the exact ones that we were holding up, and I'll just send me a note at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/Sideshow. Probably time lapse won't allow you to do that. But hold on, what go the name of your nursery again, just in case people are Googling this in the future?
Hampshire Carnivorous Plants, www.hantsflytrap.com.
And your full name again?
Matthew Soper.
Google Matthew, M-A-T-T-H-E-W, and Sideshow, and it should come up. All right, okay. What have we got next?
Number four, just look at this one. This is Cephalotus follicularis, the West Australian pitcher plant. It's a single genus species that only comes from a small area around Albany in southwestern Australia. Really bizarre and unusual. It really is like the little shop of horrors, as it were. With a small lid, which does close down, but not as you would think to ensnare insects. It closes down when it's extremely hot to stop the digestive fluid from evaporating. but it has these really sharp overhanging teeth around the mouth to stop anything climbing out again. And inside is a bath of digestive fluid. They are rather small, but in close-up, they look fantastic. They really are bizarre plants.
In the same way we call it with the last ones, how does it work when the insect goes into it?
This is a purely a pitfall trap. So it relies on usually small crawling insects, like a woodlouse or something that sort of size, climbing up and falling into the bath of digestive fluid inside the trap. They are very efficient, but really very small, but just fantastic looking plants, extremely unusual.
Apparently really very much the shop hours. We've got one more, which is, oh God, wow. Right, so the only way I can describe this one is it looks like some Norse man got one of those, what would you call them, one of those bone, teeth bone saber things that he would carry around with wine or something in it, strapped to his waist, and it comes with the cord as well. I'm not joking you, that is absolutely fascinating, but the upper part looks like an ordinary houseplant.
Right, this is an Nepenthes, which is the Latin name, common name, monkey cup. The name is very interesting. These come mainly from the island of Borneo and Sumatra, Indonesia. The name, common name, monkey cup, comes from that orangutans have been known to use these as cups, fill them up with water and drink out of them. And I've actually got a photograph of orangutan drinking out of one of them, which is very unusual. This one is one of my own hybrids and named after my daughter, Rebecca. She's 17 now. When I named it after her, she was quite young. Now she's not that keen on it, but very, very unusual plants. There is one in Borneo that can get large enough to catch mice and rats, the Nepenthes raja, but they got these very unusual cup-shaped appendages which are produced on the end of the leaves. Look at it.
I gather that that one works in kind of a similar way to the one previous, which the insect crawls in and it traps it. Or can you explain that a little bit different or better?
Yeah, these have a rather strong digestive fluid in them. Similar to the ones that the insects land around here, attracted by a sweet nectar, then they fall down into the digestive fluid and the plant slowly digests them. These are tropical plants, need to be kept very warm and humid, very similar to orchids, Phalaenopsis orchids, same sort of conditions. They're grown for their foliage. This is not a flower, by the way. Again, this is a leaf, an adapted leaf. Plants do produce flowers, which are very boring, brown, buddly looking type flowers. So this is really a foliage plant. But they're just bizarre and unusual. I mean, have you seen any other plants like these? Flytrap, the Sarracenia, the Sundew. They're really unusual, and there is a lot of interest in these plants now.
This is going to sound like an odd question, and I'm not trying to have a pop at the people who buy these plants in any way whatsoever. But there's two people in my head, and I identify like with the seven-year-old, which is, you know, like, holy wow, like, that's freaking, you know, it's amazing stuff. But do you get people who... even you might turn around and go, ah, oh, come on, lads, now this is a bit OTT, like you're worse than I am at buying them. And are they the weird and wonderful, or are they just the normal Joes who actually have a fascination same as you did, except now they're like 77 instead of 7?
Whole range of people that buy them, if you all sorts of people, men, women, girls, boys, all sorts of people from all different walks of life. It's quite unusual, actually. Lots of people grow them, yeah.
There's
not a set type of person that grows carnivorous plants, put it that way, yeah.
Okay, well, that's kind of what, you know, I was expecting them to say, well, they're all AC/DC you know, they're all used to being to Led Zeppelin, now they're just, they don't wear the leather jacket or the denim anymore. You do most of the garden shows, or you seem to do a fair amount of them from talking to Rob. How do you find them? How's that going for you?
Yeah, they're good. They're good to get the name out. Chelsea's obviously the most well-known show that we do, and we've been very successful there. We've had 19 consecutive gold medals at Chelsea, this year being our 19th. So next year is a really big year for us because it's hopefully number 20. So we'll be putting a really big display on there, a single genus display of the Sarracenia, which I said earlier are my favourite plants, of all the different forms and varieties. So that's what I'll be doing there.
Have you done, or will you be doing, or many of them will you be doing, let's say, in 2018? Or what's your aim on that? Is it Hampton, Tatton, and maybe a couple of other on the peripherals?
2018 will be our biggest year, really, because it's our 20th Chelsea, 20th Hampton Court, and 20th BBC Gardeners World Show. And all of them, we've had 19 consecutive golds at those three. So it will be
a very big year for us, yeah.
Has the planning, and for those who aren't aware, like I've seen the planning and the displays that have happened at Chelsea and Hampton and in the floral marquee at Tatton as well. I mean, it really, really is admirable. You walk in, you just don't sometimes know what you're going to get. I saw some of the floral display, they actually had a vinyl player made out of flowers that turned, had the inner of a Barry Manilow record, I should add, which is the best thing that ever happened to it, and the outer part was flowers, but again, like, the whole thing revolved, and I was just fascinated, in not because one could get floral flowers to stick to something that turned, but more that the thinking went a little bit outside of the box, so to speak. How much planning has gone into making what I would know, and it's obviously not in your case floral, but or not as much, to making one of what I will now call one of your floral displays at Chelsea?
Chelsea next year, we want to really pull all the stops out and do similar to what we did this year, but on a much grander scale, bigger, a huge range of Sarracenia plants. It's going to be absolutely spectacular. It really will be. And it's a shame you can't see it, because it really will be a good display.
Like, if we take from June 2018 and backtrack, how long were you planning the 2018 garden? Were you planning the 2018 garden? Are you planning the 2018 garden before you started actually planning the 2017 garden?
I knew what I wanted to do. But the trouble with these plants is that these are all herbaceous perennials. Everything you see here has been produced in the last 9 weeks. 9 weeks ago, they were just bare pots. Sometimes we get phoned up by the PR people at the RHS saying, what are you putting on at Chelsea next year? I don't know until a week and a half before we go up to the show. We grow a bed of 100 by 15 foot just off display plants. So a week and a half before the show, we pick out the best of the best. It's an extremely worrying time, the 4 weeks build up to Chelsea, because I just don't know what's going to be good and what isn't going to be good, because all the foliage has to be produced just before we go up to the show. Some are good, some aren't. And the ones that aren't, don't go.
That's just horticulture and plants. As I would say, if I planted 300 plants, you know, 1, 2, 3% might decide, oh, honey, I don't like living in this exact spot. I think I'll keel over for a while, or I'll die back for a little bit, or I won't grow as well as the fella to my right.
Oh, you could say that, but the difference is that some of these plants are 35 to 40 years old that have grown from seed, and if they don't look good, you can't get them anywhere else. I'm the only one that's got them. You can't get them anywhere else.
All right, folks, look, what can I say? This has been, it's been slightly unusual. It's maybe a little bit, you know, half get to know the grower. I don't know. I've never really dwell on these things, and sometimes I never really do the research, but I think it's been kind of half semi-educational and a half, as I would describe it, chatting somebody up at the bar thing, except on a microphone in place. If people want to find out more and you're stuck for any of this and you're on the road or you're on the tube, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/Sideshow and Sideshow.com. And in the meantime, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. It's been great. Thank you very much.